Today's date is August 21st, 1997. The speaker is Carol Berkland. The topic is relief for the needy. Is it what they really need?
From Mozambique to get away from civil war. You see, they just went across the border into Swaziland. And also there have been some refugees from South Africa as well. So I went there to do somewhat of a planning mission. That's not gonna work. That's all right. I'll just put it here. When I have to point something out, I'll hold it up. I think it's come to the end of his life. I went there to do an evaluation of a program, and it was one of those times where everybody thought we'd been there long enough, it was time to close it down. The refugees were going home, et cetera, et cetera. So in Swaziland, there's a royal family. And it's a small little kingdom, but there's a royal family there. Most of them are called the Dlaminis, that's their name. They are related to the South Africans. But it doesn't matter. I mean, Swaziland is a very modern city. You come in, there are Toyota dealerships and whatever. But when you meet the people in the government, like we do whenever we go on these trips, in this case, we had to see the Minister of Home Affairs, who was responsible for all of the refugee camps and all of that work. And his name was Prince Sabandla. And we came to his office, and he's wearing his native costume, which is essentially a little piece of cloth across one shoulder and this little skirt and sandals. I had never seen anything like this before. And frankly, in any other African country, I have never seen people dressed this way. I mean, if you go into any government office in Tanzania or Zambia or whatever, they'll be dressed in Western clothes and a suit and whatever. But in Swaziland, it's different. They're all a family. So they wear these costumes. So then he tells me that he's a graduate of Boston College. So here he sits in this outfit, showing a lot of skin. And tells us this. Well, about 3 years later, every year the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has a meeting in Geneva. So all the people who deal with refugees in all African countries all over the world, they come, they send representatives. I happen to be walking down the court, and because LWF does a lot of work with these refugees, the UNHCR is really close to us. So a lot of them just come up to say hello and how are you, and we do some business while they're all in town. So I happened to be walking down the corridor that day, and I saw this man and I passed him in the hallway, and I thought, my goodness, I know this person, but I couldn't place him. So my boss was standing there, and I walked past a second time, and then he said, "Oh, Carol, have you met?" And all of a sudden, it just clicked. I knew exactly who it was, and here he was standing in a three-piece suit, and I said, "You're Prince Sabandla from Swaziland." He said, "Yes, I am." And I said, "I'm sorry, we met 2 years ago," before I even got it out, he anticipated and said, "You didn't recognize me with my clothes on." And I said, "Yes, that's true, I didn't recognize you with your clothes on." Okay. No, I guess Robert can run the tape. Thank you, Robert, you can start it. Welcome to this session, which is called Relief for the Needy, Is It What They Really Need? My name is Carol Berkland, and I know most of your faces, but there are some new ones today, so welcome. For the past 2 weeks, I've been here at Holden talking about the work of the Lutheran World Federation Department for World Service, which is supported by the ELCA. You are ELCA members. You give us funds to help us do our work. In total, the ELCA sends about $24 million to Geneva every year. To my department, it's about $14 million. Up until now, I've talked mostly about our work in emergencies and disasters, Rwanda, et cetera. But today, for the last presentation, I'd like to talk more about what something is, which is what is really close to my heart, and which, unlike the other subjects, have been rather disturbing and discouraging. This, I think, is a rather encouraging topic, and that is long-term development work. So, when I ask this question, and let me say first, too, that out of our budget of about $110 million every year, World Service spends about I would say between 40 and 50 million on these long-term development projects. The rest is spent on emergency work, and then what we call donated commodities, that's the LWR quilts and other grain and whatever that's in kind that's sent to us. My job specifically in Geneva is to look at the plans for all of our long-term development projects. We are an operational agency. That means we have 23 field offices located all over the world. So that means instead of taking the money that comes from the ELCA and giving it to somebody else to implement the program, we implement ourselves. We have a staff of about 100 international staff, and they represent all nationalities.
Just right in the front.
Sorry, guys. Anywhere you want. About 100 international staff and about 5,000 national staff. One of the things that I forgot to tell you in the previous sessions, which I think is rather interesting, is that out of that staff, almost more than half of these people are not Christian. And that is because we work in areas, some of our biggest programs are in areas where there is no Christian church or even a very small Christian church, like Bangladesh, like India, like Nepal, and like Jerusalem at the Augusta Victoria Hospital, where most of the patients are Palestinians and they are Muslims rather than Christians. But anyway, that's to give you an idea of how large our operation is. Okay. When I ask the question, relief for the needy, is it what they really need? I'll be very frank and say no. I mean, that's the answer. No, it isn't what they really need. let me qualify that by saying that certainly in some cases, and this is essentially in cases of emergency and refugee flows, relief is what they need. If you are a refugee and for one reason or another, usually civil unrest in your country, you have to pick up and flee for your life. You pick up what you have, you pick up your children, maybe you're lucky to carry some water, maybe a little food, maybe a couple blankets, but you run, and you usually run across the border. And at that time, certainly those people do need relief. They need it very, very badly. If they don't have it, they'll die, and they can die within a matter of days. But relief over the long term is not the answer. Relief is, as I call it, it's only a Band-Aid. It doesn't really, it just covers the wound. And when you take the Band-Aid off, maybe the wound is healed, but still, you haven't really addressed some of the major problems that occur. Even with relief in emergency situations, it's very, very important that you not breed dependency in that relief. People who get things for free, people who receive food and shelter and water and whatever, like they do in a refugee situation, can become dependent. I mean, it's kind of part of the human condition. Let's face it, if we are given everything we need, we are not necessarily, we begin to expect that's the way life should treat us, et cetera, et cetera. So we're very concerned about that, and that's also one reason why we try to repatriate these people right away. That doesn't always happen. It depends on the emergency situation. In Rwanda, as I've explained, especially in Zaire, in the refugee camps, there was no way for those people to be able to have enough land so that they could grow food for themselves. That wasn't the case. They were in a confined area. There was insecurity. There were a lot of other things going on. They had to be supported by the international community through the UNHCR for about two solid years. It cost billions and billions and billions of dollars. I can't tell you how much that cost. On the other hand, if the situation is one like we had here in Zimbabwe, or rather Zambia and Mozambique. One of the problems in Mozambique, the refugees went here, they went there, they went into Zambia, and they went into Malawi. At one time, in fact, one out of every seven people in Malawi was a refugee. So you can see how huge the population was. But here in Zambia, we were lucky enough that the government of Zambia cooperated, and they set aside a large area for the refugees. Then we, along with the UNHCR and a lot of other agencies, went in and essentially constructed a facility for these refugees. We constructed houses, we built roads, we dug water supplies, there were schools, there was everything. It was like a regular village that housed, I think, something like 200,000 people. But there was enough land available so that these people could go in the fields, they could cultivate. And that was a real success story in the sense that those people were able to feed themselves. So then they didn't have time to develop this dependent attitude. They were out in the fields, they were cultivating. They grew enough food in the Okwimi, it was called the Okwimi settlement, not only to feed themselves, but they sold the surplus to the World Food Program, who used it as relief food in other situations. So that's the ideal in a refugee situation. That is not usually what happens, however, but that's the ideal. Then, interestingly enough, when the refugees went back, we had this whole beautiful village, town, and what were we to do with it? We talked a lot with the government, and it was decided that because of the pressure in the capital, that a lot of people, if they were given, let's say, 5 hectares of land, which is really quite a lot of land, that if they would come back and promise to work and whatever, then we would repopulate the village. It was a shame to see all this go to waste. The schools were good, the roads were good, the facilities were there. That why not let the Zambians, needy Zambians, benefit from a situation that had been built up for refugees? And it was very interesting that I happened to be in Zambia looking at the project at that time when some of the new settlers arrived. And they had arrived, they'd been trucked in, and they were new and things were strange. But anyway, there was a place for them. And the first thing they asked me is, what are you going to give us? Or asked the other people, the Zambians. I mean, most of the people who work in our programs, you should know, are not white people. They are local Zambians or Zimbabweans or whatever, but usually the biggest number of staff are Zambians. And I said to them, look, you know, you've got 5 hectares of land here. There are facilities here. There's road. There's water. There's schools. There's health facilities. And then I told them the stories about the refugees. I said, look, the Mozambicans came here, and they not only grew enough food to feed themselves, they sold the excess. But they were a little upset. What are you going to give us? I said, no, you've already gotten what you're going to get. You've got land. You've got support. You've got facilities. Now run with it, and it's going to be very interesting to see if they do. We'll be evaluating that situation again in a couple of years. I hope they've managed to make a go of it because a lot of money was put into that infrastructure. Okay, so what do the needy really need? I think above all, they need a chance, and they need a chance to develop themselves, they need a chance to, number one, identify what their problems are, because they know their problems better than anybody else. They need to think about what their needs are, and they need to participate in that process. That is very important. And most times, you know, people will, they know what their problems are. These people are not stupid. They know what their problems are, and they have a pretty good idea of how to solve them. I think I've jumped a little ahead. No, I guess I'm not. I'll come to that later. Okay. No, they need to identify their problems. They need to think about what their needs are, and they need to participate in a process where they can become accustomed to sitting together, to discussing, and to determining what their needs are and what some solutions might be to their problems. Then that's the time. That's the time that the outside assistance comes in. And sometimes the outside assistance through LWF comes even before that. What we do is we try to organize the people so that they can come together. They have a system or a structure in which they can sit and discuss their situation and what they think their problems are and how they can be solved. I have seen some situations, though, when people are so poor and they, especially if they have been brutalized in civil wars, they don't even have the ability to do that. And so in that case, sometimes you have to come in with some ready-made solutions. You just have to go into a situation and look and say, look, these people are in desperate straits. They need water, they need this, or they need that. And what you try to do is, at least in the very beginning stages, again, not to breed dependency, but at least to show them that there is some way that their lives can be bettered. But they have to see that, and they have to see it rather quickly. But usually that stage doesn't last too long. But in many cases, they do know what their problems are, and they have an idea of what should be done. We had a situation in Tanzania where there had been a drought in the north near a town called Arusha, which is in the northern part of Tanzania. And the Lutheran Church in Tanzania is very strong there. They called on us to help do some relief distribution to these people in this because of the drought. And it was interesting. There, our staff person in Arusha is an Ethiopian, but he also happens to be a Muslim, which is very interesting, especially because he was working very close with the ELCT, with the church. But he knew his business. He knew how to operate in these kinds of situations. And the church development department, which is filled with a lot of good people, Tanzanians, they said, oh, here's where the problem is. Let's just get beans or corn or whatever and drive out there, park the car in the middle of the village, and Hussein, his name is Hussein Watte. He said, no, that's not the way you do it. Because in every emergency situation, there will be some people who are not bad off. There are always degrees of vulnerability with any kind of emergency situation, and our terms of reference are what we believe is that we are there to help the most vulnerable. We're not there to help people who can get along by themselves. And so they said, the church people said to Hussein, well, how are you going to do that? And Hussein said, you go into the village, you get some volunteers from the church, you go in there, and you start asking questions. And they said, oh, they'll never tell you anything. But in fact, they did say. And in many communities, you find this out. They'll be very open, and they'll say, oh, this is a widow here. She doesn't have a husband, or their livestock died, or whatever. These are the people. Everybody in the community seems to know who's really the most vulnerable, who needs the help. So that's how we started with the emergency work. And it was very important that we started this way, because then we knew what the community was like. If you go into a village, you know how many people there are, you know who they are, you know what they do, you know if they're wealthy in terms of the village, if they're vulnerable, if they're widows, et cetera, et cetera. And then that data is what you have when you move then after the emergency phase into a development phase. And that's how you start building your development project. It's very important to do that. That is what we call the baseline data collection. You have to know where your community is before you start doing your work. Otherwise, how do you know if you're being successful? Unless you know what the status of the community is. So that's why it's important not to rush in, not to just dump a bunch of stuff, but to move slowly, find out who they are, find out, you know, if your goal in your project is to, for example, increase agricultural production, you got to know how much they're growing of what before you start, so that 5 years later when you measure it, you can find out if it's been positive or if you've been a success or a failure. Anyway, that taught us a lot about these people in this project. It's called, nowadays in a long-term development phase, it's called the Simanjaro Integrated Rural Development Project. And we asked the people, or Hussein Watte rather, asked the people to have meetings with them and said, okay, what are your major problems? And then what do you see as solutions? And it was very interesting that when they listed the solutions to their problems, the next to the last, and they put it in a priority, the next to the last was, we need money. They didn't need money. They needed assistance in agriculture. The land had been degraded. They needed a lot of assistance in environmental rehabilitation. They needed better agricultural techniques. Perhaps they needed some better seeds or some grain storage facilities. But it was very interesting to say that very few people said they needed money. I wonder how many of us would have not said we need money first. So, it's an interesting process to go through. In Mozambique, I'll tell you kind of a funny story. We had worked with these refugees when they were in Zambia, and then since we also had a program in Mozambique, when they came across the border for repatriation, we could also assist them then. And what I'm telling you now is a process that looks perfect. It doesn't always work that well. But with these Mozambican refugees, we had worked out a project with them. And for one reason or another, apparently we're not quite listening to them as we should have been, doing the regular thing, water development, agricultural development, income generating projects, whatever. And in one of these community meetings, someone, and this was such a good thing to see, somebody had the courage to stand up and say, no, we appreciate this program, but what we really need is we need how to learn to read and write. Many of these refugees had been born in Zambia. In Mozambique, the language is Portuguese. I mean, they have their local language, but Portuguese is very important for them to know. And they said, we can't get anywhere as returnees unless we know how to read and write Portuguese. Because we go to the towns, we want to do business, we want to take our produce, we want to sell, we can't communicate. So please, please, teach us Portuguese. So we changed the project and added an element of literacy. Literacy, surprisingly, is a very, 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 I think when people are in such bad situation, reading and writing, but it's very, very important. Okay. Doing long-term development it's not easy. It's a very complicated process. And those who think it's simple, unfortunately, those who in the past have thought it simple have squandered literally millions and millions of dollars, especially in Africa, and there's very little to show for it. We've made a lot of mistakes over time. One of the things about LWF that we're not particularly good at, though we're in the process of changing, since we're such a good emergency operation, we have a lot of people working for us who know how to do things and do things quickly. They can just move fuel or supplies or grain or whatever, they can truck it. And so that kind of mentality, and that's good. I mean, those are the kinds of things, they can do things quickly. That's the kind of talent that you need in an emergency situation, but is exactly the wrong thing that you need in development. There you have to be slow. You sometimes don't see positive results. You can't be results driven. And a lot of these people who do emergency work are very results driven. We're trying now to do training to say, no, slow down. Because what we do is we move, we have an emergency phase, then we have what's called a rehabilitation phase. That's the time where we look more at infrastructure of repairing roads and bridges and schools and hospitals and that kind of thing. And we're also good. LWF is also good in building. We have a great reputation as builders. But then you move into this kind of work with the community that in the end is the only kind of work that's going to have a real lasting impact. And there we have the same people. I mean, we can't employ one person to do one thing and one person to do another. It has to be a total mindset that everyone has. And we've had some difficulty with that, but we're learning. One of the things we learned was in Tanzania, in central Tanzania, where for many, many years we had a big water development project around the town of Singida. And we drew, I don't know how many boreholes we drilled, hundreds and hundreds of boreholes for water. Singida is a very dry place. We have been doing this for about 15 years. Today, the goal was to provide as much clean water per person as possible. So it was a thing where you would say, we will have so many boreholes for so many people, because there are certain UN standards. You have to have so many, I'm not sure, I don't know the figures, but that's how you know to space your borehole. So you don't have a borehole with 500 people who are drawing water, because you'll totally, right away, the water table will just go down, the well will go dry, and you'll have nothing to show for it. But even after about 12 years of drilling boreholes, today in Singida, there is less coverage of clean water per person than there was 12 years ago. Now, why do you expect that happened? Any idea?
Increased population.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. We didn't tie any kind of family planning program. We just went in and did one thing. We did water. You can't do that. You can't just do one thing in a situation. You have to take into consideration the other circumstances that are surrounding it. We didn't consider population growth, and then we did it, unfortunately I have to say, we did it for free. We went in, said, oh, it's important. Of course clean water is important. It is the thing, it is the one thing in a community that also solves a lot of other problems. You have clean water, you don't have health problems. So you not only solve the problem of just drinking water and water for irrigation, whatever, but you also solve a lot of health problems if you can provide clean water to a community.
What kind of family planning would you have been able to do? Do you have any idea?
Information, and then access. I am very much for this. It was interesting, I forgot to say, and when I was talking before about this project, the Simanjaro project, when we asked the men in the community to identify what they think are the problems, and then the women in the community to identify what they think are the problems, sometimes they line up. But in this case, there was one thing that was on the women's list that wasn't on the men's list, and that was access to birth control and to not only information, but access to birth control devices. And so I was very, very adamant and said, look, these women are asking for this. They want this. This isn't something that's being pressed on them. If we are going to talk, if we are going to give them information about birth control, then we better be able to follow it up with something that will allow them to limit their families. So it's a tricky thing because it's a very cultural deal in Africa. But anyway, I feel very strongly about that. By the way, if any time during this you want to ask a question, please just interrupt. Or no, it's not an interruption. It's not an interruption at all. Well, we gave the water was provided pretty much free of charge, because at that time the Tanzanian government was very much in the socialist phase of Julius Nyerere. A few years ago, that changed, and the Tanzanian government is now in much more into privatizing certain services. For example, school is not no longer totally free. At that time, even if we had wanted to charge for the water in that government, we could not have done so because that was just determined by the government, a service, something that was available for the people. Now there's a change in the Tanzanian government, and now we have to start charging for this water, and people won't pay. Mm-hmm. It's very, very difficult. About 3 years ago, when we went to Tanzania, I said to the people who were working on the project, I said, look, what you've got to do now is you can't start asking people to pay everything overnight, but you have to start asking them to pay bit by bit so that the subsidization level goes down and the private contribution goes up. And surprisingly, these people are not terribly poverty stricken. I mean, if they have a decent crop and if there isn't a drought or whatever, they have the capability to pay for the water. And so in order to introduce this idea of paying for services, which is just a given. It's a given in Africa now. Africa governments are privatizing, so people have to get into the idea that some of these things that were before were free, now they have to pay for. I'd like to just touch a few general rules that I think are quite important for doing good development. How you come into a situation, how you look at it. And the first one, I think, is the most important. It's the three-star rule. It's the rule that is above everything else. And that is, nobody has nothing, everybody has something, and you just have to find out what that is. No one, even in the most poverty-stricken situations, I have never seen a situation where people don't have something. They have their lives. They have talents. They have abilities. They may have not exercised them, but the potential is there, and you've got to find it. Don't go into a situation looking, oh, at these poor people, how bad they are, it's so terrible. It may be, but always look at the potential in the person because it's there. It's because this person is created by God. And I use the example of the loaves and the fishes. I love this example. You know, when Jesus was there with all these people and the disciples came and said, we got to feed these people. What are we going to do? The first thing that Jesus said is, what have they got? What is there? What do we have to work with? And that, for me, is the cardinal, if there's one rule in doing good development, is that. Look first to the people, not what you can give them, not what can come outside from charity, etc., though outside assistance is necessary. Look first at what they've got. Don't go and create something, because it's going to fail. it really is going to fail. I've seen so many times where people have gone into an area and they organize these groups of people. When you're trying to get people to sit down and discuss their problems, you know, if you artificially organize a group of people, it's going to fall apart. You know how it is. You like to work with your friends, right? If you're in a community, there's some people you like, there's some people you don't like. And if you force people, if you were the outside group that sets up these groups or tasks or whatever, or makes people work together who don't want to work together, it's going to fail. So always use the structures that are there. And the structures are in these villages. It's quite interesting. One of the groups of people we work with most are what are called TBAs, and they're traditional birth attendants. These are the women, usually the older women in the village, who assist with births. They're like midwives. And what we do is we give them some special training. They know a lot already, of course, but sometimes they need some special training, and we give them that, and then we give them a certificate. And that's wonderful. I mean, to see the look on their faces after they've gone through this little class and they have a certificate that they hang in their house. What this does is it increases their respect, even within the village. First of all, they're respected because they're old. Number two, they're respected because they've got this certificate in their house that says to the rest of the community, we are something. Then you work through them. You do other things than just, you know, birthing and whatever. You use these people. They become the community leaders. So, and there are these kinds of structures in every village. You just have to find them. And our problem is we have not taken the time to find them. We've gone in thinking we've got the answers. We know what's wrong. We've seen the situation. It's so bad. And we fail because we don't take the time to look and find out what is there. Okay, the second general rule under that is never give away anything free. If it's possible, never, never, never give away anything free. Sometimes you have to, as I said, but don't expect that people can develop themselves in a fantasy world. That's what I say. I mean, we live in a world, and granted, it's an imperfect one, and it's an unjust one, and we would like to see that it was more perfect and more just, and I'm glad that there are people who are working to do that, to see that happens, but it happens. But in the meantime, people have to live in the world that is here. Don't try to develop them in a way that makes them believe that you get things for free, that you don't have to pay back loans. You know, there is no free lunch. There isn't. And if you really want to help people, the worst thing you can do to them is put effort and ask them to work hard, and then the situation that you've created is somehow unrealistic. Like, for example, if you're doing income-generating projects, you've got to be very careful that there's a market for that. You know, just don't come into a place and start. I've seen a sad story of women who decided that they could start manufacturing school uniforms, because in Africa you have to wear uniforms to school. But there was no market, or to ask them to make handcrafts that should be sold to tourists when you know very well that they don't have any access to a market, they don't have any transport, the roads aren't good, etc. So when you assist people, be sure you assist them in a way that's realistic so that they can succeed. They failed too much before. And the touching thing about watching people in these situations is that they work so darn hard. They really do. I can't tell you how hard they work. And to see them work, put all this effort into something that's going to fail because somehow you are not... The program that you have created does not reflect the realities of the world right now. You're doing them a terrible, terrible disservice. Never ask people to do what is not in their self-interest. You and I wouldn't do it. Why should they do it? This you see a lot in environmental projects. I mean, you and I in the West, here in the United States and other places, we have the time and the economic pad, let's say, to do things just totally for the good. Most people that I see in these programs, they don't have that. For them, it's a matter of survival. Don't ask them to plant a bunch of trees just because the place is deforested and it's the right thing to plant trees. They won't do it. I mean, why? They have to see that there's something that's going to happen that will benefit them, or they're not going to do it. This is the whole problem that we had so long with the national parks in Africa. Why should they protect the animals? Just because we want to come and look at them and be on photo safaris? Why? When they can shoot an elephant and get I don't know how much for the tusk. So what you have to always do is somehow tie the good to their self-interest. And if you do that, it will work. And I think that that's just the way it should go. Let me tell you about an afforestation project in Malawi that is just an excellent one. All of these communal plots have not worked. People have to, at least at this point in their development, they want their own. They want to have their own, they want to produce their own, they want to sell their own for a profit. The communal reforestation projects have been almost a total disaster because they're just asked to go out and work on something that they see no way that this is going to personally benefit them. And then you've got the extra hard problem with forestation projects because, my goodness, it's going to take how many, 10, 15, 20 years before they see these trees? They need something now. They don't have time to wait for 15 years. What we've done in Malawi is, this is one thing we do give out free. This is one of the times when I say, okay, forget everything I said about not free. It is okay, it is always okay to give tree seedlings for free. I honestly believe that because these things are so inexpensive. Just have a little seedling, it's about this high, it's in a plastic deal. And you pay people to come into these nurseries and raise these things, distribute them to the farmers. But then they can do with them what they want. Give them some instruction on how to water them, whatever. But these trees that we have planted, they're not a eucalyptus, because eucalyptus can sometimes be very toxic to the soils. But they are very fast-growing trees. And so the idea is you raise a certain amount of trees and you can sell them. The need for firewood is incredible in Africa. And these trees mature in about 3 or 4 years, even less than that. Mm-hmm. But the idea is if you cut, you have to replant. And all you have to do is sow that idea that one or two farmers start doing that. The others see that, wow, this happens real fast. They have firewood for their own consumption. The women don't have to walk 15 miles a day to get the wood. They can have firewood. They can then take some of that wood and sell it and make a profit and use it to buy school uniforms for their kids or whatever. And the idea goes like wildfire. But always, always, if possible, tie what you're doing to their own self-interest and in a way that they can see very quickly this is a personal benefit to them and their family, and it will go. And then later on there'll be chance for the community-wide stuff. But right at this time, they need to see positive impacts. That's the next one. Plan so that whatever you do, there is some result, some tangible result that they can see very early on. If not, it's like you or I, we'd give up. You know, some guy walks into, or some woman walks into our village and says, we're going to do this and this and this and this. And believe me, people don't just stand there in Africa waiting for a Land Rover to come into their village for some person to get out and do something with them. And these, in many cases, I must tell you, this is the other thing that is really bad about the failed development that we've done in the past. It's not just the fact that we've spent money on machines that are now littering the landscape of Africa, rusting, and it's what we've done to the people, what we've done in making promises that we've not been able to deliver on. I can remember going one time on an evaluation to Cambodia with a really excellent water technician. And for some reason or another, in that case, it was the project itself. And luckily, the program director in Phnom Penh was fired after this evaluation. I don't like that to happen. I don't like people to be fired after evaluations because that means that, you know, people get afraid of evaluations. But this was so mismanaged. They had promised these people water for about 3 or 4 years. They would come out, they'd say, okay, now you pick the site for the borehole. So the people would go around and say, okay, we should have one here, we should have one. Then nothing happened. And in the end, you know, they just sit there and say, why should we believe any of this? Why should we? So be sure that if you make a promise, you can carry through on it. And if you're going to do something, and if you say you're going to do something, that they can see it and understand it and taste it and feel it and touch it very soon. They deserve that. And that's only fair. Technology on its own is never, never, never an answer. That's another big mistake we've made in the past. Going and digging boreholes, thinking, okay, now we've prepared, we've got these people, they've got clean water. I've seen so many broken down boreholes all over Africa, it just makes me sick. They break down because, number one, there has been no community development around the technology, and that's what's necessary. Technology is not wrong, but you've got to organize people around that technology, because in the end, people are going to make the technology work. And if they can't make it work, then it's just going to fall apart. Train people how to use the boreholes. Organize a community structure so that when a part breaks, when something breaks, like if the hand pump breaks on the borehole, that number one, there's a way where they can collect money to replace that piece. Be sure that you have spares available. So it's not just going in and digging a borehole and walking away, because if you do, it's just going to fall apart. And it's more, in development, you always have to look below the obvious. One would think, if you saw the film the other day of the clean water coming out of the tap in Bolivia, I believe it was. It's much more than that. If your goal is to improve community health by providing clean water, then digging the borehole is only about 30% of getting to your goal. Sure, you've got to get the borehole. It's not always boreholes. It can be shallow wells, whatever. But that only delivers the water to the surface, okay? After the water comes from the surface, you've got to be sure that that area around the borehole is protected, because if not, you're going to have animals in there, you're going to have everything, and it's going to be unsanitary, and you might as well be just drinking water out of the closest ditch. You've got to be sure that the people know how, especially the women, and that's why we always work with, in these situations, we work with the women, because the women are traditionally the people who go to fetch the water and carry the water. And in many cases, I've seen just absolutely pristine surroundings of these boreholes where they put up fences so the animals can't get in. It's all clean. The women have organized. There's a pump attendant, so there's a person who knows if it's broken down. She knows if it's broken down. She knows what to do. She knows how to order the part or get the part or whatever. So that's important, to build a community structure around the technology. But then if the vessel in which she's transporting the water from the borehole to her home is unsanitary, or if it's stored in the home and it's not covered and she uses the dish that the dog drinks out to put the water in you know, her children's, or let them drink out of it, I mean, you might as well not even have a borehole. And then comes even the more difficult one, which I never saw. I heard a friend of mine talk about it in Tanzania, but I never saw it until I went to Cambodia. In Africa, there are not a lot of, in the dry areas, there's not a lot of surface water standing around, rivers, whatever, and people drink out of the rivers. In Cambodia, on the other hand, there's a lot of standing water. There's a lot of rain in Cambodia. People prefer the taste of the stagnant water to what comes out of the borehole. It's a matter of taste. They like it. They drink that water, clean water that comes out of the borehole, they say, yuck, it's so awful. A friend of mine, who's the head of one of the heads of the Lutheran Church in Tanzania, lived by a river, to this day says, I prefer the taste of that river water. But of course, it can kill their children. Mm-hmm. So again, you've got to then try to make the mothers understand that yes, the water may taste better from the river, it may taste better from wherever they're collecting it, the surface water, but it's going to kill their babies. So
is there any way to do anything with the water from the river?
Possibly, but I think it's probably a little too complicated and expensive. It would probably involve having a certain supply of something.
We use water pumps. Pardon? You know, we use like a water filter, water through.
Right, but they don't have access to that. They wouldn't have access to that.
You know, taste the.
So it's easier. And when you're thinking about a problem,
it gives a taste.
When you're also thinking about a problem, think about the easiest solution, not the most complicated one, because the complicated one probably won't. I mean, it's the whole issue of small is beautiful. It's really true in development. So teach the people to do, or tell them that all they have to do is boil the water. You know, that's simple. Almost everybody has firewood, everybody has a pot. You boil the water, it's going to work. I cannot tell you the number of meals that I've had in African homes where you look around and you say, if I eat anything here, I'm going to die. But you just, one thing you do is you just watch how they, I've eaten in Maasai huts in Tanzania, but I saw that stuff boiling away like crazy, and I haven't gotten sick.
She's still here.
But remember, always remember, the simplest suggestion and the one that the people can handle. Okay, before you come into a situation, know how you're going to get out, because you can't be there forever and you don't want to be there forever. This is what we call in development sustainability. Can what you have done sustain itself? Can it go on after you've left? And if you can do that, then you are successful in development. And we have been so unsuccessful in that. We have made projects that have been high tech, that have been imposed on people, that have not done all these things, you know, that I've taken into consideration these things that I've said, and they fail, because once the professionals leave, once the outside money dries up, what's going to happen? You have to try to plan your projects in such a way that the local people and their resources can sustain the project. And that is one of the hardest things that I must tell you. When I worked with the ELCA in Chicago in the Global Mission Division, we had all these people who were just wanted to give things. You know, they wanted to go and build schools and hospitals and big, especially it was infrastructure, big buildings. And I'd say to them, but where's the money gonna come from to repair the windows when they break? Who's going to re-roof it? Who's going to do this or that? They don't think about it, you know. They just like, they want to be generous, and that's good. And you want to support that generosity, but you want them to be generous, smart. Mm-hmm. And sometimes being generous, smart means that you back out of the picture. I mean, I know they love to. Some of the synods, you know, they have big projects and they send the money and they go to Africa and have their picture taken next to the, you know, the building that they built or the when they lay the cornerstone, there they are. And I'm not saying this always happens, but in some cases, those buildings are gone. They have fallen apart and they're a rusting hulk in less than 10 years. And that is a very hard lesson to try to get across to people who are wanting to be very generous. I have a friend in Tanzania. She's a very smart lady, and she started a kindergarten project, I think also in Singida. But that project, it was a little seed money that came from the outside, but then she managed through some years to make it totally locally self-supporting, and was doing excellent work. She had a visit, some German Lutherans came on a bus, got off and said, oh, what you're doing here is so great, we want to give you money. And she said, if you give me money, it's going to kill this. Don't give me money, please. Because what I'm doing now, I can walk away, I can go away, but the community will be able to carry this. It seems simple, it seems maybe insignificant to you, but for us it's really important. Don't think that you can secure people's rights for them. Now let's talk about advocacy, about trying to change the structures in the countries, many of them, which are causing oppression for these people and lack of human rights. You can't do that for them. You don't want to do that for them. Because in the process of learning what they're, of organizing them so that they can demand the rights that are theirs, they will grow as a people. They will learn to understand democracy. They'll learn how to organize themselves. It's that stuff that they do during the time they're trying to secure their human rights that's important for them as a community. You can't do it for them. You can't do it for women. You can't
tell African women that they shouldn't, that female circumcision is bad. It shouldn't happen. They have to come to that understanding themselves, and that's a process. But unless it's a process that they go through themselves and they understand, it's not going to work. It's just like, again, putting a Band-Aid on. And it's the, like I say, the process is very, very important. What we can do is that we can be sure that they know what their rights are. Many places people have no idea what their rights are. Then if you start a process where they accomplish things, but they build up their confidence, this is the main thing, in building up their confidence. And you build up their confidence by assisting them to do something, to produce something, so that, for example, in Zimbabwe, we had a situation where women went together in a group and started an agricultural project. They were growing vegetables. They were growing enough vegetables to feed themselves and sell the local market. What happens in Africa many times is a lot of land is just standing there idle. But once somebody, some unscrupulous person in the community or whatever, sees that this land is producing, then they come and try to take it away. It happens a lot. And these women just said, no, we know our rights, and you're not going to take it from us. If they had not gone through that process themselves, that they would have probably just been pushed aside. But that is a process that they have to go through themselves. We can't do it for them, but we can give them the experience and some of the things they need.
How does this apply to the hospital in Jerusalem, which seems to be like a
We're in big trouble in Jerusalem.
We're pouring a lot of money in.
When I say, before you get in, no, I didn't get out. Well, Augusta Victoria Hospital, I don't know if you know, ADH, heard of it? It's a hospital on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. For many years, it was built by Kaiser Wilhelm for his wife, Augusta Victoria, about 1910, 1911. It was a Christian hospice for many years. And then in 1948, it was turned into a refugee hospital for Palestinians after the Israeli War for Independence in 48, I guess. In the beginning, it was all subsidized, or most of it was subsidized. Its operations were subsidized by the UNRWA, the UN Refugee and Works Administration, which provided 80% of its support. Somebody, sometime, should have said, ah, this situation may not go on forever. What are we going to do if this huge support, I mean, when you're sitting with an institution that's being 80% subsidized from the outside, you have to one time sit and think, what are we going to do if this may change, if this situation may change? And of course, it changed. The Oslo Peace Accords meant that the Palestinians are no longer, quote, refugees. So the UNRWA is gone. And now the LWF is sitting with this beautiful hospital. I mean, it's a wonderful place. Have you been to Jerusalem? Have any of you seen it? It sits right up in the top of the Mount of Olives. Anytime, any place in the old city of Jerusalem, you can see it. And it's not only the hospital, it's the Christian presence there that's been there for so long. And the Lutheran World Federation program is extremely well thought of. It's really touching now. The person who's the head medical officer of that hospital was born there. He was born there. And it's always hard to be rational about Jerusalem. It's the kind of place that produces irrationality. But now we are desperately trying to find, we need $10 million. Because what happened is after the UNRWA left, the hospital had been a refugee hospital. Now we realized that in order to take advantage of the fact that these people, these Palestinians, were now being covered by an Israeli health insurance scheme, we had to bring the level of the hospital up to code so that we could then, the patients that were treated there, the Palestinians who were treated there, could be covered by the Israeli medical insurance. So that meant we had to put millions into it just to improve it. All the time hoping that the money would come in, that the Lutheran world would somehow realize that we were in trouble and we needed the funds. Funds didn't come. They didn't come from governments, they didn't come from Lutherans, And then, and just to keep the thing going, we had to advance from World Service. We usually have about $6 million in reserves in Geneva, and we need that money because we get pledges from the ELCA and from Denmark and whatever, so we can run our programs, but those pledges don't all come in at the same time. And we had this reserve fund so that, knowing that we were going to get, let's say, $12 million from the ELCA, we'd advance that money, or we'd advance a portion of that money out to the field so we could continue operating our programs. We have now advanced $5 million of that to ABH. Our reserve is gone. At the Hong Kong Assembly, it was voted that we cannot advance more than $500,000 more to it. And I think the Germans have finally gotten the message that since it was kind of, it's always been kind of a German thing from the beginning, that they should really dig deep. So they're going to the government now. And one of the people who's been very helpful in all of this is Bob Bakker. I don't know if you know who he is. He's the head of finance and administration in the ELCA. He's a fabulous man. He's brought a lot of expertise, and one of the things he's brought is this kind of cold American practicality to a situation that was a lot of dreaming was going on. And Bishop Anderson has been really good too. There's going to be a meeting now in October. It was supposed to happen in Geneva, but it's been changed to Bonn, and Bob will be at that meeting. And I hope that's a good sign that the German government is about to hand over some money. But the German government is in a terrible situation now as it is. Unemployment is huge. Social programs are being cut. So I don't know. We do have an offer from a Roman Catholic group to cooperate with us on the running of the hospital. We wouldn't change the name. They're a Roman Catholic group that has hospitals all over the world. They're not officially tied to the Vatican. It's like Lutheran Social Service is to Lutherans. They're not with the Lutheran hierarchy, but they're certainly Lutheran. And they have, if we will give them that opportunity to come up on the Mount of Olives and cooperate with us, they have the $10 million, which we need. But there is some people, especially the Germans, who are saying, we don't want the Roman Catholics up there. And so I say, fine, if you don't want the Roman Catholics up there. I think it'd be fine to operate the hospital with the Roman Catholics. I think it would be a great ecumenical witness in a situation that is almost entirely Muslim. So I say to the Germans, you know, if you don't want the Roman Catholics, let's see the color of your money.
Yeah.
Show me the money.
Let's see the color of your marks. So I don't know what's going to happen, but it has turned into a nightmare. And that's what I meant about institutions. You have to be very, very careful with institutions. Mm-hmm. Oh, the time's gone. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I didn't even get to be. I was going to tell you about the Grameen Bank. You know, those microloans, it's not a magic bullet now for development, but giving people access to credit, but always with interest. Never, 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 never give a loan without interest. Of course, it can be a modest amount of interest compared to the market, and that's why the Grameen Bank was founded, because these poor people were being literally exploited by loan sharks. But it's a wonderful idea, and look at us. If we're starting some kind of entrepreneurial business, could we get along? Could we get along without access to credit? No, we couldn't. Mm-hmm. So they need credit as much as we do. And I'm telling you one thing: poor people pay back the loans much better than rich people do. Mm-hmm. The percentage of default on those loans, and their little loans of like $25 and $30 and $40 to groups of women who are manufacturing this or that or whatever, the payback rate is something like 98%. There's very little default. Can I just read something to you? These are the rules. I saw this. This was in the Seattle paper. I couldn't believe it. Talking about the Grameen Bank, and if you want to look at it afterwards, you're welcome to. But I just wanted you to read these rules because they're so good. These are the borrower's rules. Those who borrow from the Grameen Bank follow a set of principles that commit them to improving their own lives and that of their families. Number one, we shall follow and advance the four principles of the Grameen Bank: discipline, unity, courage, and hard work in all walks of our lives. Number two, we shall bring prosperity to our families. Number three, we shall not live in dilapidated houses. We shall repair our houses and work toward constructing new houses as soon as possible. Four, we shall grow vegetables all year round. We shall eat plenty of them, and we shall sell the surplus. Number five, during the plantation season, we shall plant as many seedlings as possible. Six, we shall plan to keep our families small. We shall minimize our expenditures. We shall look after our health. Seven, we shall educate our children and ensure that we earn to pay for their education. Eight, we shall always keep our children and their environment clean. Nine, very important, we shall build and use pit latrines. 10, we shall drink water from tube wells. If it is not available, we shall boil our water or use alum. 11, we shall not take dowry at our sons' weddings, nor shall we give any dowry at our daughters' weddings. We shall keep our center free from the curse of dowry. We shall not practice child marriage. 12, we shall not inflict any injustice on anybody, nor shall we allow anyone else to do so. 13, we shall collectively undertake larger investments for higher incomes. 14, we shall always be ready to help each other. If anyone is in difficulty, we shall help him or her. 15, if we come to know of any breach of discipline in any center, we shall go there and help restore discipline. 16, we shall introduce physical exercises in all our centers. We shall take part in all social activities collectively. And if you do that, you can borrow money. And that's development, I think. So,
those banks are international?
Yes, they've now become international. It's interesting here that you see a picture on the front. This is a picture of a lady of Chicago with her grandson. There's a bank in Chicago based on this very principle called the Full Circle Fund. This lady was so smart. She got the idea that she could manufacture for African American graduations from African American high schools, these kinds of mortar boards and decorations on their gowns that were in kind of an African motif. So she needed money. She was a seamstress, so she got a loan from the bank, and she started making these things. And it's just, of course, it's gone like wildfire. Mm-hmm. It's gone like wildfire.
Did you say Tacoma?
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Oh, one last thing I can say is don't feel guilty if not everybody takes the opportunity for development. People are people. And I think of the story of Jesus and what he says to the disciples, you know, if they don't listen to you, take off your, you know, take the sand off your sandals and go somewhere else. And that's the way it is with development. I know it may sound a little harsh, but I've seen places where in one place, both communities have been given the same situation. And I saw it in Malawi with the tree planting, and it just didn't go. I mean, people just didn't do it. And instead of spending a lot of time in grief, thinking, oh my goodness, we're not doing well enough, go somewhere else. Because what you've got is a good program, and there are people willing to run with it. Mm-hmm. There is such a desperate need. And that, I don't mean that in a harsh way. But go where the need is, and those people who will take it and run with it and become independent and will be able to operate on their own, they will. And if others don't, go to some others, because they probably will. So.
And maybe at a later date, you know.
And maybe at a later date, yeah, it'll catch on. Mm-hmm. Right. We are not in charge here, you know. If we really think that, we think, oh, you know, we're the good, big people who come here and everything. It's not that way. Sometimes we just have to do what we can do and then let it go.
Are there some spots, though, that are so terribly degraded that the options are very minimal? I guess I'm thinking what we hear about Haiti, for instance, or Dominican Republic. Or are technology being what it is, are there other options that can be developed rather than agricultural and things like that?
I would suppose there are places. I've been in Haiti and I've seen those places, and it looks like the landscape of the moon. But also, I've seen them in Ethiopia as well. I don't know. I'm not a technical specialist. If I have, you know,
are there places where you just don't have programs that would suit what their needs are, or as I say, or is technology making, you know, communications a viable place for them to?
Yeah, I think there. One thing I say is that sooner, I think that this is what's coming in the kind of work I do, that within the next 15 or 20 years, I think that all of the hands-on work is going to be done by local people. And I think that's good. Any young person who comes to me and says, oh, I want to work in Africa, I want to be in development, I want to do this, and I say, well, it's very nice. But really, I think that there isn't a great future for you. And that's not to say that there shouldn't always be people who give some support. But by and large, Africans have the capability of doing this themselves. What they don't have is access sometimes to information. And there is technical information now. I said this the other day to somebody when I was in Malawi. We were walking through a cornfield, and it looked really weedy, and it wasn't very good. And the man who was with me, who's an expert in agriculture, said to these people, he said, well, did you know they also grow tobacco in Malawi? He said, did you know that if you take the tobacco and you boil it up, you can use the syrup as a natural herbal...
weed killer?
Herbicide? Yeah, weed killer. Herbicide. Right. And these people didn't know it. You know, they just didn't know it. But this guy knew it because experiments or work had taken place in some of the big agricultural universities in the north. And so I think more it's going to be an information groups of, like us, will be kind of a hub for information.
So we'll consult them for helping themselves, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see the Lutheran World Federation within the next 15 or 25 years no longer being an operational agency, but serving more as consultants. And serving more in the consultant area, not just in those kind of technical things like agricultural development, whatever, and helping these people now to plan, to monitor, to evaluate the projects, because they'll continue to get the money, the money that they need from the governments, for example. Now the money goes the Danish government, Dan Church Aid, LWF Geneva, to the field. I think what will happen, it will be the Danish government to Dan Church Aid directly. They don't need us in the middle. The reason they need us in the middle, frankly, right now, is that they know that we can be accountable, that we will hold people accountable, so that we have the plans, we do the monitoring, we do the evaluations. Now we've got to start training these people not just to do those kinds of technical things, but to also to be able to plan and monitor to a point where they can satisfy the requirements of these governments, which are very, very, very difficult, because they're using taxpayers' money.
Sure.
And that people want to know that we can no longer do any work for long unless we prove that we have made a positive impact and that we can measure it. And that goes back to what I said about the importance of the baseline data gathering. We have to know the situation in the community before we start, so that 5 years later, when an evaluation team comes there, we can say, look, we did this, and we can prove it, you can measure it. Before they grew how many kilos of beans? Now they grow how many kilos of beans, and they have made such and such a profit. Or, you know, we have to be able, we can't get by just on, well, it looks good anymore.
Accountability.
Doesn't work. Okay, thank you very much.
We're past time.